I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. A provocative new book is out. It's called The Big Shift, The Seismic Change in Canadian Politics, Business, and Culture, and What It Means for Our Future. Its authors are Daryl Bricker and John Ibbotson. The premise of the book is that Canada has been run by a political, media, and business elite along the Toronto-Ottawa-Montreal corridor. Mr. Ibbotson, who joins me now, termed them the Laurentian Consensus. They're no longer in vogue, as it seems, and they've been replaced by a new coalition based in the West and supported by immigrant voters in Ontario and elsewhere. It's a shift in Canada's power structure and could shape politics for the next few decades. Just as the Liberal Party of Canada was a natural governing party for the country in the 20th century, Stephen Harper and the Conservatives have endeavored to make their party the one of the 21st century. The Messrs. Bricker and Ibbotson have a great narrative in this book. It's a necessary reading, whatever political stripe you might be, because with the reporting and analysis that's in this book, paired with the polling data and statistics, it's hard to ignore that they're both onto something. Daryl Bricker will be on the program in the coming days. John Ibbotson is the chief political correspondent for the Globe and Mail and spent time as the Queen's Park and Parliament Hill columnist, as well as the bureau chief for the Globe's Washington and Ottawa bureaus. His previous books include Promised Land, Inside the Mike Harris Revolution, Loyal No More, and the excellent The Polite Revolution. He was last on for Open and Shut, Why America Has Barack Obama and Canada Has Stephen Harper. The Big Shift is published by HarperCollins. Please welcome back to the Plant on the Line program in Ottawa today, John Ibbotson. Mr. Ibbotson, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
So, as I said, I'm a big fan of the talk that you did for Big Ideas and the piece that appeared in the Globe and that was in its entirety in the Literary Review of Canada subsequent. It's a fine piece of writing, and it gave us this term, the Laurentian Consensus. How did you come up with that term?
I wasn't quite sure whether I invented it or whether somebody else invented it and I stole it, but no one else is coming to claim the thing, so I guess it's mine. In essence, what I was arguing was, and you've really introed it quite well, that for most of this country's history, the political and media and cultural and academic elites in the big cities along the St. Lawrence River and its watershed debated among themselves the major issues of the day and, generally speaking, reached a consensus on where the country should go and implemented that consensus, often through the Liberal Party, which was most of the time was the government of the day, though sometimes through the Progressive Conservative Party as well. And for the most of the history of this country, they shaped the country. And by the way, they did a good job. Canada is a fabulous country, and we owe them much of the credit for it. But the fact remains, for good or for ill, that in recent years, their influence has been waning. And in the May 2nd, 2011 election, they lost their influence completely to a new conservative coalition. And that coalition consists of the traditional base of the Conservative Party, principally in the West, but a West that is growing in population and in wealth and in influence and very soon in seats, and in coalition with middle-class suburban voters in Ontario, especially middle-class immigrant suburban voters in Ontario. The recent immigrants, the two Torontos worth of immigrants that we've brought in the last 20 years, many of whom are more economically and socially conservative than, say, the immigrants who came over from Europe after the Second World War. So if you take those two groups, a growing West that is no longer a region, we call it the West the New Center, and you add it to these suburban, middle-class immigrant voters in the big cities of Ontario, you get the Conservative Coalition and the displacement of the Laurentian Consensus, the Laurentian elites, as the governing force in the country. We think it's a major change. We call it the big shift. And we think it's, at least for the foreseeable future, more or less permanent.
Now, you mentioned that the Laurentians, the Laurentian elite, I should say, they did accomplish a great deal, and much of it we all embrace today. Where did they go wrong? Was that the arrogance that they thought that they ran this country?
I think a couple of things. The most important was, yes, they started taking the immigrant vote for granted. The Conservative Party had always been anti-immigrant. The Liberal Party had always been pro-immigrant. the Conservative Party was WASP and British and suspicious of newcomers, especially non-British newcomers, whereas the Liberal Party had thrown, from the days of Clifford Sisson, when Laurier was Premier, they had thrown open the doors to immigrants from places that many other countries wouldn't take, Eastern Europe and Southern Europe, especially, say, at the turn of the 20th century. But multiculturalism and an open-door immigration policy brought in immigrants principally from China and India and Philippines, who might have been, as I said, more conservative in their outlook. The Conservative Party, under Stephen Harper, worked incredibly hard to convince these immigrants that they were welcome in Canada and they were welcome within the Conservative Party, and the Conservative Party supported open immigration. But it supported other things as well, for example, cracking down on refugees who were illegal. And the Liberals just believed that they would have the votes of these immigrant voters forever, and in fact they lost them, started to lose them in 2004, and then lost them more or less completely in 2011. That will those voters switch back? They might, but we believe that there are certain strong imperatives, especially economic imperatives, that will incline those voters towards the conservative vote for some time to come.
Now, there are people who don't buy the argument that you and Bricker are making in this book, they sort of think that Harper and the Conservatives are an aberration, sort of like Diefenbaker and Mulroney were, and that the Progressives will come back either in the form of Justin Trudeau or Thomas Mulcair even. Is it mainly sort of the old Laurentian elites that think that, perhaps? Are they deluding themselves?
Well, we think it is the Laurentian elites who think that, and we suspect that they might well be deluding themselves. If you are going to recreate the status quo ante before the arrival of Stephen Harper, you have to convince those middle-class suburban voters outside the big cities to switch their votes away from the West and towards Quebec, which remains the progressive bastion in this country, the place that voted the NDP in last time and the Bloc Québécois before that. So you have to convince those middle-class voters that the redistributionist, collective equity prioritizing voters of Quebec are where their economic interest lies. But they tend to be more socially conservative and economically conservative, as I said. They tend to be more suspicious of government, these middle-class suburban immigrants. They tend to like a message that says, we'll mind the store and do our best to look after the economy and leave you alone to prosper as you see fit. We'll keep taxes low. We'll dismantle regulations. That is, we think, an attractive message to these middle-class immigrant suburban voters. It's the same message that attracts the West. So you have to ask yourself, how do you get those voters to switch around to Quebec again and make common cause? What is in their economic and political interest to do so? Why is it in their political and economic interest to do so?
And so the issue for them would be the economy, right?
Yeah, one of the other things that we argue in the book is because of the Great Recession, and the global shifts that are going on, the rise of China and other developing nations, the relative decline of the United States, that we are undergoing a period where the economy is the only issue that will matter for a very long time. The environment, healthcare, whatever else you want to throw up against it, will be of secondary importance. In an electorate where the economy trumps all other issues, there is a tendency to polarize between those who support a party that says, the least government is the best government in these times. We'll get the economic fundamentals right and let the private sector grow the economy, and that's the best way to protect your job. And the progressive response, which says, no, the government will intervene more heavily in protecting jobs, in protecting equity, in redistributing income from richer to poor, in protecting poor regions of the country from the full economic impacts of these changes at the expense of the wealthier parts of the country. In such polarized debates, we believe the conservatives are more likely to win than the progressives. For one reason, in other countries where there are two-party systems, conservatives tend to do better than progressives over the long haul. And again, as we said, we don't think the redistributive message that progressives are putting forward is one that will appeal to, let me say it one more time, mm-hmm. immigrant, suburban, middle-class voters outside large Ontario cities.
So you mentioned that Harper and the Conservatives have done well in cultivating the immigrant vote. They've sort of embraced immigration now, where they probably would not have done that, say, 20 years ago when they were Reform Party members. At some point, though, don't immigration rates become unsustainable? I mean, do we continue on this path?
I think we continue this path for a very long time. I sure hope we continue on this path for a very long time. It is the great secret recipe to Canada's success. We take in more people from more parts of the world than any other country on Earth on a per capita basis. And we do it better than any other country on Earth as well. We've created cities like Toronto and Vancouver where either or very soon the half the population is born overseas. We bring them together. We live together. We work together. We create together. We open fabulous restaurants together. We make babies together. And we produce this kind of, I'd call it a post-national multicultural society that is working fabulously well. And that is slowing the aging of the population, is slowing the aging of the workforce, is creating more workers, more entrepreneurs to pay the taxes needed to look after the boomers like myself as we start to get old and sick, and that is making all in all a pretty fabulous society. Why would we stop that? Why would we not carry on for as long as we possibly can?
How has urban Canada changed? I mean, is that still the refuge or of the Laurentian elites? I mean, even in Vancouver?
The Laurentian elites tend to live in the downtowns of the big cities. They tend to be university educated. They tend to have higher incomes. And in the past, they tended to command the loyalty of those suburban voters who would vote along with the voters in the downtowns. But what has happened is the votes have split, so the suburbs are no longer voting with the downtowns. The suburbs are voting with other regions rather than with their closest urban neighbors. So yes, you get in here in Ontario, you get Brampton and Mississauga, Etobicoke, even within the city of Toronto itself, Ajax and Pickering. Nepean outside Ottawa, the suburbs outside London, these large middle class and also very highly ethnic ridings, supporting the voters in Calgary and Edmonton and in suburban Vancouver. Again, the Lower Mainland is very much a duplication of the Greater Toronto Area, a liberal elite, small L as well as large L, in the urban core. And then the farther you get from the core, the more likely you are to be finding suburban conservative voters.
So the urban core, who they vote for, that won't change?
It's hard to say at this point, but there's no sign that they are changing their support. It's the last place where the Liberal Party still has a real bastion. Now, what will happen to that vote over time? Will the NDP and the Liberals merge? Will the NDP replace the Liberals as the progressive alternative to the Conservatives? And if so, will those downtown votes shift? That's an interesting question when we explore in the book. We think that at least until 2015, there's not likely to be any change. We also think that the 2015 election favors the Conservatives. You can never tell, every election is a crapshoot. But we think over the long haul, at any given election, the Conservatives are favored, unless and until the Progressives either merge together or one of the two parties becomes exceedingly dominant, pushing the other party into marginal territory, rather like the Liberals pushed the NDP into marginal territory in the 20th century. Unless and until that happens, it's good for the Conservatives at any given election.
So I'm 30, and I've grown up most of my life with the issue of national unity, sort of the overall issue affecting Canada. What I found encouraging in reading your book is that Canada isn't as fragile as say it was even 5 years ago.
No, we that's what we believe. There are two things going on. One of the things, and it's not a good thing, we call it the Ottawa River Curtain, which basically divides everything west of the Ottawa River, which is growing, immigrant-friendly, growing in economy, growing in population, entrepreneurial, and everything east of the Ottawa River Curtain, essentially Quebec and Atlantic Canada, where populations are declining, governments are saddled with debt, businesses are having a hard time making a go of it, immigrants are for one reason or another, feel unwelcome in those environments and tend not to come to it or tend to leave it if they do come to it. That's a problem for the country, and we wish that curtain would rise and the eastern portions of the country would join the western portions of the country in pursuing growth and pursuing immigration. But the other side of it is, yes, there is, as everyone knows, never been less support for separation than there is right now in Quebec, again, because economic issues are trumping nationalist issues. And we believe that outside of Quebec there is a remarkably robust new patriotism emerging among younger Canadians, immigrant Canadians, that says the country is great, the country is fabulous, and we should be proud of it and stop apologizing for it, and stop worrying about whether or not we're too much like the Americans.
Now, Idle No More was a big part of the national discourse in recent weeks, and it sort of retreated. How does what happened this past winter, how does that factor in sort of this big shift that you're talking about?
It's something we explore in the book, although obviously we wrote it before the Idle No More protests broke out. It almost looks as though we predicted it.
Yeah.
We believe that there a window is closing for First Nations. The immigrants who are coming to this country from China and India and the Philippines and elsewhere feel none of the historical guilt and responsibility that the descendants of the Europeans feel rightly, because we did commit some pretty terrible acts against the First Nations over the decades and generations. The immigrant Canadians say, well, you know, for one thing, we empathize with you. We come from countries that were colonized ourselves. Or the countries that were brutally exploited by colonial powers. So we know where you're coming from. But it wasn't us. We didn't do it. And there will be over time, as more and more of these immigrants come in, again, two Torontos in the last two decades, there will be less and less patience for the historical grievances and claims, treaty and land both, of the First Nations. Now, yes, they have the courts to protect them, but as the saying goes, judges read newspapers. And over time, if an electorate is becoming increasingly impatient and intolerant of the demands of First Nations, that will start to be reflected in judicial decisions as well. So we're urging First Nations people, first of all, think about mostly what you need to do in order to break the cycle of poverty. How can you get education onto reserve? How can you get health care onto reserve? How can you protect the rights of women on reserve? And secondly, if you're going to do a deal, do it now, because you're going to get a better deal in those treaty rights and land claims from the government that you have today and the society that you have today than you are going to get 10 or 20 or 30 years from now, because, in fact, every year it's only going to get worse.
And what's your sense? Will that happen?
I believe that there's a schism, and we saw that in the Idle No More confrontation with Sean Ashley of the Assembly of First Nations. There are chiefs who are bent on grievance and on protest, but there are also chiefs, especially younger chiefs, who are more concerned about economic development, about health care, about education, about graduation rates, about making sure that this young generation of First Nations doesn't have the same tendencies to fall into poverty and dropout rates of previous generations. So I think there's a conversation at best and a civil war at worst going on within the First Nations community itself, and that was playing out as well during Idle No More.
Has this a change in voting habits, has this changed how Canadians generally are? I mean, we're sort of left-center progressive. Is there a change in that sense? I mean, have we become more right-wing, do you think?
Well, I think we've become more conservative economically. I'm not so sure socially. And I'm not so sure, in part because I'm not sure that the wars aren't over. The things that social progressives have been fighting for, equality for women, same-sex marriage, full protections for ethnic minorities, they're largely in place. They're largely won. And so it's hard to find where the next great battlefield is. It may be that the social policy field is just quiescent for a while. But on the economic side, that's still hotly debated, because the state of the economy is so important to so many people. So many of us realized after the last recession how much our own jobs depend on economic growth and economic security. So I don't know whether the country will become more socially progressive. I don't see any sign of it. But I do believe it's becoming economically more conservative, and that's to the conservatives' advantage.
What can progressives do, or what can they learn from this book? Is there still a place for the Laurentian elites in this new Canada after the big shift?
I don't know if there's a place for the Laurentian elites, but there's plenty of places for progressives.
Yeah.
And progressives, we talk about it in the book, progressives can respond to this, but they have to respond by accepting a couple of assumptions. The first is, you can't just write the West off anymore, the way the Liberals did for so many decades. As long as we have Ontario and Quebec in coalition, we can just forget about the West. It's getting too big, too powerful, too many people there, too influential to just be dismissed. So progressives have to take the West into account, and they have to find a message that appeals to voters in the West, to voters in Calgary as much as to voters in Montreal. And the second thing they need to do is they need to look at those Ontario middle-class suburbs. Who are they? What are their values? What do they hold to? What is it that they might see in a Progressive Party to attract them? You cannot run the country anymore out of the downtowns of Ontario and Quebec. You have to run the country out of the suburbs and the West. Progressives can do it as well as Conservatives, but you have to know that that's where the power lies.
And the best exponent of the Laurentian consensus was the Liberal Party of Canada. Can they ever come back, do you think? I mean, I never voted Liberal, but I don't really care, but they are part of the discourse and a needed one, I would think.
As we said, we don't know what's going to happen. We don't know whether the NDP will become so dominant that eventually the Liberals will wither and die. We don't know whether Justin Trudeau will galvanize millennial voters and rally the Liberal Party and make it a potent force once again. We don't see the Liberals coming from third place to first place in a single election. That's a very hard thing to pull off, virtually unheard of. And so we have no idea whether the Liberals revive or fail to revive, whether the NDP and the Liberals form a new party, or and when. But we know that some version of this has to happen somewhere down the line. It took a decade, remember, to get the Conservative Party back together again, and it was one party that had split into schism. It's very hard to get two different parties with two very different traditions to merge into one. It may take a while, but it may also be necessary.
John, I'm a fan, as you know, so it's been good talking again. Continue good luck with this book.
Hey, thanks very much. It was a pleasure.
The book is called The Big Shift, The Seismic Change in Canadian Politics, Business, and Culture, and What It Means for Our Future. HarperCollins is its publisher. Written with Daryl Bricker, John Ibbotson on the line from Ottawa in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.